Hey everybody, welcome to episode 2 of the 2QB Experience. I'm one of your hosts, my name is Greg Smith. On the line with me, your other host, Joshua Lake. How you doing, Josh?
Doing well, good to be back.
Yeah man, episode 2, I'm pretty pumped up. How about you?
Yeah, this is good. I have been pleasantly surprised at how much interaction there is on Fantasy Twitter, even though we're in February.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good stuff. I mean, you might as well have a season or a year-long hobby instead of a season-long one.
Yep, and the feedback we got from the first episode was largely positive. We really appreciate everybody checking out the podcast, hanging out with us here in your ears, and we're here to do it again. And I want to get right to it. Kind of want to start off by plugging a couple recent things that came out on 2QBs.com. The first is a piece that you wrote, Josh, a defense of Philip Rivers.
Essentially, the argument is that Philip Rivers is kind of the forgotten QB1, that he is not talked about, he's not thought of as a sexy pick, but he's someone that has thrown for 4,000 or more yards in 7 of his last 8 seasons. He's had at least 26 touchdowns in all 8 of those. He really is a very consistent, low-end QB1, extremely safe to be a high-end QB2, which maybe in a one-quarterback league, that's not very valuable. You want more upside, but in a two-quarterback league, that's extremely, extremely valuable, that certainty. And then I also threw in some stats about how he plays with and without Keenan Allen, just suggesting that he's much better when Allen's on the field.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a question about that specifically. Even if Allen comes back and is fully recovered next year for 2016, isn't it possible that other teams are going to try harder to take Keenan Allen away? I mean, the NFL teams know that Phil Rivers plays better when Allen is on the field. How much is that Allen taking away attention by the defense versus just his own talent level elevating Rivers? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think the unfair answer is that it's too early to say exactly what this Chargers team is going to look like. Antonio Gates is a year older. They're probably not going to have Malcolm Floyd, at least last I saw. Ladarius Green could be moving on. We don't know, but there's reason to hope that the running game is stronger. I think that this Chargers offense could look significantly different than it did this year, particularly if they have all their receivers healthy, the ones that are coming back. To me, it's a little too soon to say. I think that Allen is a weapon, though. I think he's such a good talent. Rivers is so used to throwing and just funneling through the tight end because his receivers are fine, but nothing extraordinary, that I think Keenan Allen having a near elite or elite wide receiver, we've seen that it can boost quarterbacks. I mean, you look at what DeAndre Hopkins has done for anyone that is thrown to him on a bad team and bad quarterbacks, or Josh Gordon in Cleveland. I think we've seen what a top-notch wide receiver can do, and I think Allen is going to be pushing that level this season if he's healthy.
Yeah, the one thing I'd really like to see the Chargers do to improve my perception of Rivers from a fantasy perspective is to improve their offensive line a little bit. You really saw the negative effects of that on their running game last season. And, you know, if they can block a little better up front, they actually weren't a bad pass rush defending team. But in terms of running the ball, if they can get a little bit more push up front, keep teams honest with the run, I think that'll really be a boon to Philip Rivers. I'll be interested to see what they do in the draft and free agency to see if that's a point of their team they try to address.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that line is a huge need. That was probably a large part of why their running game struggled, is they just had terrible run blocking, like you said. For what it's worth, the early ADP that I've seen, which there's very few drafts going on, but it looks like Philip Rivers is right around QB10 right now. So depending on what his price looks like around draft time, he may not be nearly as exciting as I think he will. But my hunch is he falls a little bit like he does most off seasons, just because he's not that sexy name. The young guys will start catching up and maybe passing him as their hype builds.
Yeah, it was really easy to talk yourself into Philip Rivers after his 2013 season when he, I think, was a top 10 QB. And since then, he's been a little disappointing. I know that this year he finished about 16th in terms of points per game among quarterbacks. The year before, 2014, he was 15th. It's going to contrast with our spotlight QB later. I should have noted that at the beginning of the episode. This is the Matthew Stafford experience in episode 2, folks. but in general, Rivers' average finishes in terms of points per game has been right around QB 15, QB 16 over the past 4 years. And that surprised me. But it's, you know, it's, he's about average. So if he's going 10th overall among quarterbacks, that seems too high to me. If he does slip into that, you know, 15 or even like 12 to 16 range, I'd be a lot more interested.
I agree with you. I think the QB 10 range doesn't leave him a lot of room to return value. He's not going to finish too far above that, I would expect. So you want to see him fall a little bit to become more interesting. And one thing I will say is he has been like some other quarterbacks, Eli Manning or Matt Ryan, also valuable in just that they're consistent. They're going to be on the field. He seems to be a pretty stable. He hasn't had a lot of injuries. He also isn't like he isn't one that has any risk of being benched. So that adds some value as well.
Yeah, and that is one aspect of two QB leagues where that matters more in a two QB league than it does in a one QB league, because if your one QB quarterback gets hurt, there's a waiver wire full of other options, most likely. Whereas in a two quarterback league, you know, consistency, longevity, that stuff matters. And it, you want those guys that you can reliably count on week to week, even if you're not starting them every week, which is often the case. With that said, I want to move on and touch on one other. This is a series of articles that's going on the site. These are the Armchair Scouting Reports by Anthony Amico. And damn, are they good, man. He is breaking down all the rookie QBs who are, you know, going to get drafted here at the end of April. I know you're looking forward to them at the Combine. I am too. And I kind of want to springboard off of these arguments with a Twitter question we received from Taylor Christensen at My Sleepers. He asks, where do Carson Wentz and Jared Goff factor into rookie drafts that take place before draft day? So that's a dynasty question. And then he says, what about the rest of the QBs? I think we should isolate our answer to Wentz and Goff for now, just because we don't have too much information yet. But where do you expect these guys to go in rookie drafts, Josh?
Yeah, it's still really early in the season, and most people aren't drafting this early. But I have an article up on 2QBs.com that looks at rookie drafts over the last couple of years in two quarterback leagues. And in both years, the top two quarterbacks were generally gone by the sixth pick on average. And I don't know that the consensus is going to be that Jared Goff and Carson Wentz are at the level of Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota, Teddy Bridgewater, the way they were perceived coming out. Maybe they will. There's still a couple of months, but
it seems like they're not at this point.
That's kind of my sense of it as well. And just reading through Anthony's analysis as well. And like you said, they are really incredible articles. I would commend those to you. It seems like he feels the same way, that maybe they have that potential, but the hype isn't quite as strong as it was for some earlier prospects. So I would say these are likely to slot in that middle of the first round kind of range. It could be that one of them or both of them really shine at the combine and hype grows and they become top three picks in the NFL. That would obviously raise their stock. But I would say they're likely on average going to be somewhere in the middle of the first round.
Okay. And that sounds about right to me, if only because we are talking about two quarterback leagues. And even if they're not, you know, top tier talent, if you can get a guy who's going to have a starting gig for the next 5 years or longer, that has value in a dynasty league, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And obviously it should go without saying, but your league really is going to determine things. If you're in a league where quarterbacks are the first and second pick in your rookie draft every year, go with that. I'm only talking about on average across all two quarterback leagues.
Yeah, that's a great point. And just in general, let's say you were drafting a redraft league right now. Where would you expect these guys to go in a 2QB or a Superflex league?
Pretty late. I think that it looks very likely that one of them goes to the Browns, and I'm not convinced that either one would push out Josh McCown, at least at the beginning of the season. And so right away, I would think that one of these quarterbacks is going to start the season as a backup, and then where the other one goes is a little less clear. So I don't think that these, if you were drafting today, I would expect they're outside of the top 20 for sure.
Yeah, I don't even think I would count on either of them as my QB3 at this point, just because we don't know where they're landing. And like you said, where they land, if they'll even start. But I thought that was interesting. Someone did follow up to Taylor's question with that question about redraft. But let's move on. I want to ask some of my own questions. I just asked some quick hitters for you, Josh. Some of these are a little silly. Some of these are a little more serious. Quick answers, unless you want to go a little deeper. First one is, would you rather play in a Superflex league or a 2QB league?
Ooh, that one, that's a tough one. I don't know. I could see arguments for both. If I had to pick and I'm playing in just one, I probably go two quarterback because I think being forced to start two requires you to have knowledge of the deeper quarterbacks. And I feel like that's one of my strong areas in fantasy football is knowing the worst quarterbacks and being able to roster ones for cheap. So that's my preference, but Superflex has the benefit of just the flexibility. There's more strategic diversity for players, for fantasy owners that aren't as familiar with deeper quarterbacks. It gives them an easier intro to multiple quarterback formats. But for me personally, I would choose two quarterback. What about you?
I also prefer 2QB, but I do think Superflex is the best kind of bridge format. Like if you're not sure how you want to play, I think you should start with Superflex. With that said, you can always do it the other way around and dive headfirst into a 2QB league. And if it's a little too intense for you, then you can kind of backslide into a Superflex format. I mean, to me, there really isn't that much of a difference. I have maybe started a non-quarterback in my Superflex spot like once in the past 3 years. It doesn't happen very often in the leagues that I play in, and that might have to do with scoring settings more than anything else. But generally, I think you want a quarterback in that spot anyway, even if it's like a bad QB for the most part. But yeah, I'm with you. I tend to prefer the rigidity of two quarterback over Superflex. Question number two. Would you rather start your draft quarterback, running back, or wide receiver, wide receiver?
Wow, are we putting specifics on what format you're playing?
Either, you can pick.
Okay. Right now, man, that's tough. There are so few running backs that I feel confident in right now in February that I know they should be first and second round picks that I would have a hard time picking that. So for me, it would come down to wide receiver and quarterback. And I think the reasonable answer is going to be wide receiver, just because the elites are such a clear advantage that if you can have a first and second round receiver, and then later on you pick up kind of average quarterbacks and you take a lot of shots on kind of the typical zero running back candidates, the guys who are third down backs that are going to be involved in the passing game or handcuffs, things like that. I think that probably sets you up for the strongest setup. If I'm just picking kind of absent any more details, I'd probably go receiver.
Okay. Yeah, I think it is a context driven question, because like you said, right now the running backs are so murky. As the season approaches, maybe we'll start to feel better about certain guys. Like if we see Le'Veon Bell get healthy, we see, you know, Adrian Peterson look good in the preseason again, and you could start to talk yourself into, oh, maybe like this running back and this running back are guys that I want. But that having to pick another one again in the second round, that's what makes it brutal to me, where like I'm okay, you know, speculating on a guy I believe to be, you know, one of the top three running backs in the first round or top five, whatever you want to say. But when you have to wrap around in the second round and just take another one, yeah, no thanks. I would also go wide receiver of the three options there. Any love for tight end?
No, I'm not an early tight end drafter, but I really don't know that going for a second round tight end makes sense. I can see Gronk in the first round. I don't personally do that very often, but I really can't see a reason to go Gronk and then someone else, even if you have two flex spots.
Yep. All right, next question. Would you rather own Tom Brady or Drew Brees in 2016? And this would factor in what you expect their draft price to be. Not necessarily who you'll have ranked higher, but, you know, in terms of value, which one do you think you're going to prefer this year?
That is very tough. I think probably I would default to Breeze because I expect him to go later. I think the two will end up close. I am worried that Brady is very near his age cliff, what we've seen Peyton Manning go fall completely off of this last season. Brady is, I'm not willing to say he is there, but you have that risk. Obviously, Brees has a risk as well, but he's younger. My concern is that Drew Brees' numbers last season don't look nearly as good as if you take out his one just ridiculous game.
That one against the Giants.
Exactly, where he and Eli just threw touchdowns every other pass, I think.
It's something like that. Sounds right.
if you take that out, his numbers don't look as impressive. I mean, he's still very good, don't get me wrong, but I still think he is good. I think he is less of a concern about an age cliff than Brady is, and I think you can get him later. So it's close. I like both of them fine, but I would probably default to the one I can pick later.
Yeah, I think that's the correct answer. That's what I would do as well, is whichever one's cheaper, that's the one I want. How about some keeper questions? If you're in a keeper league, would you rather keep Cam Newton in the second round or Tyrod Taylor in the second to last round?
Tyrod Taylor, that is such a – the price difference is so huge there.
It's all about value, right?
Right. As a starting quarterback with great upside in the second to last round is something you should never pass on.
And that is a reasonable price point you could have paid last season for Tyrod. Maybe not in a two-quarterback league that drafted late enough, but – in a lot of leagues, maybe you drafted him sometime early in the preseason before it was clear that he was going to start for the Bills. And I could conceive of a situation where you got him that late and could keep him there this year if that's the type of league you're in. Let's keep going. Assuming the same keeper costs, would you rather keep Ryan Tannehill or Ryan Fitzpatrick for next season?
That's a tough one.
I'm putting you on the spot over and over again here.
You are, and I'm having to pause longer and longer on each of these.
Oh, I'll edit all that out. Don't worry.
Hey, there you go. I look smarter. This is good editing. I think I probably go Ryan Tannehill, which is really terrible to say, and it's painful to say, but he had a rough year. But Devontae Parker is coming on. It is a new coach who hopefully will allow Ryan Tannehill a little more flexibility. The story just came out today, actually, as we're recording, that the coaching staff, Bill Lazor, wouldn't allow Ryan Tannehill to make changes at the line. He could not audible and make changes. I don't know that Tannehill is going to be capable of it, but there's at least potential. Man, I hate myself even as I'm saying it because I like Ryan Fitzpatrick so much. It's a close call for me. I think Ryan Tannehill has a little more potential to – he has a lot more potential to outdo his last season. Ryan Fitzpatrick, I think, could get close to his last year numbers or very possibly could regress from them. And if they're at the same price, I think I'd probably go Ryan Tannehill on upside. But, man, it's painful to say.
Yeah. All right. A few more here. This one actually was your question. Would you rather eat a live cockroach or draft Nick Foles?
Well, what's your answer? It was my question.
Oh, I have to answer it? Cockroach for sure.
I mean, we don't even know. It is one of the most bizarre stories I have heard yet this offseason that the Eagles are looking at Nick Foles after trading him away.
It's unbelievable to me. I don't know why they would even consider that. He didn't look good on the Rams either.
Right. It just comes off as a we hate everything Chip Kelly did. We want to get back to pre-Chip Kelly.
Screw you, Chip. All right. Would you rather rely on Josh McCown, Brian Hoyer, or Case Keenum in 2016?
Josh McCown. Throwing to Josh Gordon is a great thing. If Gary Barnage looks anything like he did this year, that'll be helpful. We've seen that Josh McCown has upside. I think Brian Hoyer is in more risk of not being the day one starter than McCown is, and Case Keenum still plays for Jeff Fisher.
That's right. Okay, last one, and this is somewhat related based on your last answer. If Josh Gordon is reinstated, you know, from the beginning of the 2016 season, one, where do you expect his ADP to settle at? And two, where would you be comfortable drafting him?
If he's reinstated, I expect he will keep rising. If we hear good things, we see good things. I would not be surprised if he is pushing the top 10 receivers by the time we're at draft day, if he's playing in the preseason and we have no reason for concern about suspension. Where would I be comfortable? I like Josh Gordon a lot. I'm not worried. I think that if he's playing, he's motivated and incredibly talented. And we've seen, like I said, that he can succeed with Josh McCown. So I don't know that I would say right at the top 10 wide receivers, but I would have to think about it.
Okay. I mean, that would probably put him somewhere in the second round or higher, maybe early third.
Yeah, probably somewhere right around that early third range.
Man, that's a steep price to pay for a guy who hasn't played in so long. But, I mean, the talent is there. You're right.
What about you? Where would you feel comfortable, assuming all the things I said? He played preseason. We don't think he's suspended. What would you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be one of those situations where at the end of the second round, depending upon how wide receiver heavy the draft has been at that point, you know, if I had the first pick and I, you know, started off with you know, Antonio Brown or Cam Newton or whoever. And then it wrapped around to me in the second round after a lot of the other elite receivers were gone. I'd feel okay drafting him there if, like you said, if all the boxes were checked through the preseason. Maybe not comfortable, but I'd be willing to consider him there. In the third round, I think I'd be comfortable that at any point. That seems fine to me.
Yeah, it's one of those. I think that Josh Gordon is going to go very high if all of those boxes get checked, just because it only takes one owner.
Yep.
And we've seen him just be completely season changing for a lot of fantasy leagues. So I think you'll find that one owner that'll take him very early, whether it's you or not. Someone in your league is going to take him real early.
Yeah, and I'm probably not going to be that person because that's not typically the way that I draft. I know that just as a kind of a comparable example, the year that Adrian Peterson was coming back from ACL surgery, when, you know, most of the reports were pretty good, I was still terrified. I was not touching him at all in those first couple rounds, which is eventually where you had to take him just because his name is Adrian Peterson, you know? And he delivered that year. I got burned, or maybe not get burned, but I wish that I had taken him earlier, considered him a little more favorably in those drafts. But I tend to be a little more cautious when I'm drafting fantasy teams.
Yeah, no, I tend that way as well, especially with the early picks that I want safety. I will say it's something I'm reflecting on and will be for the offseason, because my personal experience over the last few years has been that I make the playoffs in nearly every league. I mean, I have a very, very high playoff percentage, but my teams don't win the title very often. And so I'm doing a lot of reflecting on what does that say about how I build a team? Is it too safe? Do I need to chase more risk and upside, or is this good kind of the way I'm approaching it? So it's a work in progress, but I have historically tended the same way as you're describing, that I want to be safe with my early picks.
Yeah, that is an interesting kind of crux of fantasy, where you do have to weigh, you have to assume some risk if you want to win everything. And in the draft, it's really easy to talk yourself out of a risky player, when in actuality, you can look back at your draft boards from previous seasons and think to yourself, well, I ended up dropping, you know, 60% of the people that I drafted, and even if maybe even more than that in some leagues. And you might pick some of the guys back up along the way, but there are a lot of leagues where the turnover on your own roster is so big that you might not consider it in the draft, that like your fifth round pick might just get cut after week two or week three. I mean, it happens. You don't want it to happen, but it will. And I think with that in mind, I've erred a little bit more towards risk in recent seasons. And, you know, anecdotally, it has paid off. I think 2015 was one of my best fantasy years ever. And I will attribute a lot of that also to the fact that I did wait on quarterback basically everywhere. It was like the perfect storm of, you know, late round quarterback selection. But yeah, you're right. It can swing both ways. You never know what next season's going to be like. But you do have to be, at the very least, you have to be very attentive and very, what's the word? I mean, just on the ball when it comes to making moves and being able to like jettison guys who aren't performing, or hold out for the guys who you think or know are going to come back and perform at the level you expected them to. I love fantasy, man. This is what it's all about.
And this is the right time to be thinking about it. The off season, where you're not making your weekly start sit decisions, you really have the distance that you can evaluate the bigger picture.
Right, and you don't have to get tied to, you know, players as commodities at this point. You can really think about these different elements of the game in a more abstract way, and I think that that's really valuable if you can, you know, lay that foundation in the offseason and then build on it once the preseason starts and you start to get more data from, you know, ADP, your own mock drafts, and all that stuff. With that said, I would like to move into our main topic, and, you know, the readers, the listeners, they've asked for it, and we want to deliver some dynasty talk. I will admit up front that I am very much a dynasty rookie, and part of the reason that I'm willing to you know, talk about this and converse with Josh about it is because Josh is going to teach me to be better at it. This is going to be great for me.
It's really all about you, Greg.
I'm one of the hosts. I get to do what I want. This is something that I dove into last year. I had never played fantasy or dynasty leagues until 2015. I joined the Faked Goods League with Rich Rebar and Chad Scott. They were kind enough to extend an invite, and I got crushed. My team was not good. And now I just have that competitive edge where I'm like mad about how bad I did. And I'm trying to figure out how I can, you know, improve upon it. The most daunting thing for me is it really is. It's that full season commitment or full year commitment, excuse me, where like I need to be thinking about this stuff now when normally in any other given year, I'd be, you know, building a fantasy baseball top 200 right about now. And so can you talk to me a little bit, Josh, about what your off-season management is like, what you care about, what you're looking for, things like that?
Sure. And off the bat, I will say that although I have played Dynasty a couple more years than you, I still very much defer to the Dynasty experts. I mean, my subscription to Dynasty League Football, DLF, is a huge value to me. Talking with several of those writers and some other guys and girls on Twitter is very helpful. So what I say comes from a few more years of experience than you, but by no means am I a Dynasty expert. So with that preface, I think what you said is a very important difference, obviously, between Dynasty and Redraft is the offseason. I actually just transitioned a league that originally had been Redraft, and we just took the same group of my friends from high school, college, just over the years, and we made it a Dynasty league. And I was talking to one of the owners actually this week, and he was saying he really isn't sure that he's going to stick with it. And his reasoning was, you know, I really love having the concentrated 15 weeks of competition in Redraft and then just forgetting it and moving on with my life. And Dynasty isn't like that. You really have to be thinking about it through the off season. To succeed, you really do. It's a year-round commitment. And commitment is probably the wrong word because, like you and I were talking about at the beginning, if you love this, then it really doesn't feel like a commitment. It's a hobby. It's something you do for fun. You enjoy it. And so in the off season, there are so many different things that you're doing. And there's a lot of great podcasts and articles out there about how to handle the Dynasty off season. But particularly in two quarterback leagues, something that isn't discussed almost at all in regular Dynasty or media is looking at backup quarterbacks and looking at the ones who have the potential to become starters in the next year, 2 years, 3 years. If you listen to any typical Dynasty podcast where they're talking about one quarterback leagues, they are just telling you quarterback has no value. You cannot trade a quarterback in the offseason because everyone's thinking, I already have one. I can get another one off waivers. I can spend a fourth round draft pick, a rookie draft pick, to get a new one. There's just no value. Whereas in a two quarterback league, quarterbacks move, they're traded, they're of great value. And so a lot of where you can spend your time in a two quarterback league is to be looking at those backups in the offseason and thinking through, what does, for instance, Jimmy Garoppolo in New England, what are his odds of starting? If he does start, if Tom Brady does hit that age cliff, if he's done soon, how good do I think he'll be? Is he worth acquiring for a third round pick? Things like that, really looking at backups, and that's just one example. There's a handful of very interesting backups. But I would say that's where you can really do a great service to your two quarterback team, is to be looking at those players and looking for values, if that makes sense.
It does. It seems like there are two different types of those backup QBs. They're the, you know, the boring guys who might just get more run because one, either they're playing behind a suboptimal QB, or two, they're playing in front of or not in front of, but behind maybe a rookie who could just crap the bed and leave the coach being like, well, I'm going to lose my job if I don't switch over to Mark Sanchez or Ryan Fitzpatrick or Blaine Gabbert, you know, like those types of players who maybe based on previous experience, you've seen them be bad, but like they could transition into that starting role. Those are like the boring, unsexy guys. Now on the flip side, you have your, you know, your Tyrod Taylors, your Matt Flynn's, your Jimmy Garoppolo's, your Brock Osweiler's, the guys who we haven't really seen much of. And then when we do get a glimpse, we're like, holy cow, like these guys could be great. They could be starters. And those guys definitely seem to have more value in the abstract for a Dynasty League. But it seems like in terms of what you would have to pay, it might be worth it more to target the boring guys. Does that make sense? Is that something that lines up with your experience in Dynasty?
No, I think that's a good point, that they will be a lot cheaper. Brian Hoyer was a guy that you could get for basically nothing. Josh McCown, you could get for basically nothing. Ryan Fitzpatrick as well. A lot of and not that every one of them hit. Matt Cassel would be on that list. Brandon right. Whedon for a time was on that list midseason.
Great point.
So it's not that they always hit. To your point, you're exactly right. They're so cheap that if they don't hit, cool, you just dump them and move on. If they do hit, you may have a reliable QB2.
Right. Now, in terms of the draft picks, this is something where I have a real hard time wrapping my brain around the value of rookie draft picks. And I know that when I joined that Dynasty League last season, even through the draft, like we were maybe through a few rounds and I was getting trade offers that involved future picks. And, you know, because I'd never played in that sort of league, I had no idea what to do. How would you advise valuing those future picks? Maybe not in terms of overall value, but just relative to these QBs, not necessarily backups, but like, you know how you could assign like maybe a first round rookie pick to like a average NFL starting quarterback. How does that scale for you? Does that make sense?
Right. It does. I mean, what is essentially the cost to purchase a quarterback?
Exactly.
Because that's one of your main currencies. I mean, you can always trade a player, but your currency, one of the main ones, is your rookie picks. I would say that it's very similar to what you hear in one quarterback leagues, that for the elite players, the debate is somewhere, or the consensus, I should say, is somewhere between 3 and 4 random first round picks gets you the top end players. So that is for wide receivers, the Antonio Brown, Odell Beckham, Julio Jones, DeAndre Hopkins. But I think your top 4 quarterbacks also fit into that same discussion. So those elite guys are probably going to take 3 first round picks, random first round picks. So if we're talking 2017, the ones that get later, it obviously falls off, and that's going to be more league dependent and owner dependent. So
yeah, who needs what?
Right. It could be that you find an owner who has a Carson Palmer and is deciding, you know, my team's not good enough. I really need to move to rookies. I want to get younger. And so he may move Palmer for a relatively cheap price. Whereas if you're talking to a contender, then Palmer is much more valuable to them. So it really gets harder to say clearly what these players are worth, and it becomes more context dependent as it goes down. But given that the rookies are going to take probably a top 5, top 6 pick to get, people are thinking in those terms in 2 quarterback leagues. So they're saying, look, do I want to take one of the rookie quarterbacks, or would a top 5 rookie pick be better spent trading for a quarterback? And that's kind of the way most people are valuing it. It gets much more murky when you're looking beyond that at some of the lesser rookie quarterbacks or the lower tier starting NFL quarterbacks.
Well, yeah, and we're also glossing over the fact that those picks can also be used on wide receivers and running backs, and you still have to fill those positions too. So the complexity is pretty insane. I want to talk a little bit more about offseason management in general. And first of all, looking at, you know, the big thing that's about to happen for Dynasty, which is the Combine. This is February 26th to the 29th. What are you looking for out of the Combine? You mentioned DLF earlier. What resources do they provide that, you know, somebody who's new to Dynasty might benefit from? You don't need to, you know, cherry pick specific writers, but what's the sort of stuff that you want to see after the Combine regarding the players you're interested in?
Sure. So we're not affiliated with DLF. We're not paid by them, nothing like that. But I just think they are such a great resource that I talk about them a lot. They just had an article go up by Leo, and I'm blanking on his last name. He used to be FF Houdini on Twitter and has since rebranded. But he had an article about certain players that he really is interested in and what sorts of things would be helpful to see at the Combine, either to say, look, they are better at this than we thought, or look, these concerns were legitimate. So articles like that are helpful. I actually was just a guest host on the RotoViz radio podcast and really learned a lot listening to John Moore and Luke Easterling talk about running backs and which specific drills they think are important. So the 40-yard dash may not be as important as some people think, whereas the three cone or some of the more agility-based drills are more important. But for me, at least, because my strength is quarterbacks and that's where I focus, I rely heavily on people that look at the other positions and who tell me which stats are important, which ones correlate well with NFL success, those kinds of things. And I really rely on both RotoViz and DLF because they have so much experience and so much research that goes into their opinions.
Well, that's a lot of what being a good fantasy owner is all about is, I mean, there isn't enough time in the day for you to research everything. So you have to lean on other resources. You have to grab a data point here, grab another data point here, mush it all together inside of your brain and say, like, okay, based on this, from these sources that I trust, these are this is what I think. These are the players that I like. These are the players that I don't like. And my reasons are X, Y, and Z. And it really is easy to become your own expert if you can, you know, manage that information well. The problem comes with when you get information that might sound important, but then you find out after the fact that it's not, like the 40-yard dash, like you just mentioned. So you have to be careful with that stuff. And there really are a lot of great resources. We hope to be one of those for you, of course. But we're not the be all end all. I mean, we get information from other people that informs our own opinions. You do need to seek this stuff out on your own and figure out what works for you. After the combine, is there anything that you care about before the draft in April?
I think that one of the things that is important to be thinking about, and I've been hearing over on the Dynasty Blueprint podcast, those guys have been talking about, is roster space is something you want to be conscious of, because when the rookie draft rolls around, that means 4, 5, 6, however many picks you have, if you use those, you need to have roster spots for those players. And so rather than being kind of stuck as you're making a rookie pick thinking, well, now I've got to dump someone, instead using those 2 months we have left before then, or 3 months, whenever your rookie draft is, using those months to try and make trades that bring value to your team, but also maybe turn 2 roster spots into 1. So you send a wide receiver and a running back and get a better running back or something like that, so that you're making space on your roster and gaining value instead of being stuck at your rookie draft where you have to just dump a player out into free agency and you don't get any value back for them. I think that's an overlooked strategy that a lot of people aren't really thinking about the roster spots in advance of their rookie drafts.
See, I'd be worried that people would be able to sniff that out a little too easily. 2-for-1 trades are always something that I'm wary of. And of course, I want to be the person who's giving two nickels to get a dime, essentially. And I feel like in sharper leagues and experienced leagues that's a lot easier or a lot harder to get away with. Do you have any advice for trying to make that work?
No, I think you're absolutely right that most of the sharper owners are going to say, you know, I'd rather, they're going to think the same way. They want the roster spot. They want the better player, etc. So it does not, I guess what I would say is, if you're throwing out these offers that are, hey, I'm going to be cutting these two players, will you give me a good player for them? That's the wrong way to go about it. That's not going to work. There are certain players on your roster that really just deserve to be cut. I cut Cordarrelle Patterson off a roster the other day and just love doing it. But
you're high-fiving yourself.
Yeah, at the same time, I'm just kicking myself for what he cost originally. But it's one of those where don't just send trash to someone. That's not what I'm talking about. But instead, you're sending legitimate starters. Maybe they're not a starter for you, but you're sending. So in a 2-quarterback league, if you have 3 or 4 really solid NFL starters, maybe you're sending one of them. You're sending an Eli Manning or a Matt Ryan along with another position player and saying, hey, can I get a better position player? And so that starting quarterback may have value to the other owner. It'll really help upgrade their team. So you're not just sending garbage. You're looking for trades where it really will benefit the other person, and maybe they only take a small downgrade at the other position.
Yeah, it is something I've realized where you have to play with the value of players, or at least the perceived value of players a lot, and you have to try to identify which guys you own that are at the peak of their value and what you can get for that. And contrastingly, you need to find the guys who seem undervalued on another player's team to say, okay, I'm going to you know, on the surface look like I'm losing this deal, but because I'm opening up a roster spot, because I'm getting a guy who I think is going to, you know, regress in a good way back to a better value, those are the types of deals that tend to work the best in my limited experience.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point.
Okay. I have a couple quick questions for you regarding startups versus rookie drafts. Now, if you're going to draft a startup, how aggressively are you trying to win right now in the first season? And how much do you lean towards the future and you know, setting yourself up for long-term success?
I tend towards not giving up in a year. While I think there is a legitimate argument to be made for setting yourself up to win down the road, I don't find that to be as reliable an option in startups, because by doing that, you're inherently taking more risky younger players who you certainly hope their value goes up. That's the theory behind it, but you're going to miss on some of them as well. That's just the nature of taking those risky players. So I tend towards more of a, let me make myself a competitor now, but then also find younger players, maybe not the elite young players or the, that's not the right way to say it, because an elite young player is going to be an early pick, but not the sexy sleeper names, but instead just some guys that aren't as highly valued. They're young, using the later picks on the guys that are more risky and younger, but looking for more reliable options early is kind of my approach to it. But it certainly is something that I take in a lot of input from other people. I think you do need a mix of both, but I tend to lean towards, I don't want to give up in a year and just kind of throw in the towel before I even get started.
So in a startup, how aggressive are you in terms of, you know, trading future draft picks to try and win now? Because this was something that I really struggled with, was knowing the value of my future picks versus what I have in this moment and what my opponents have, and vice versa. Like, I don't know if I get a third round rookie pick from my opponent, is that worth me giving up I'm trying to think of a good example player, someone like Breshad Perriman, a guy who was disappointing the whole year, but you know, that wasn't the reason I drafted him. I didn't draft him for the first rookie season where he was injured. I drafted him to be someone that I could rely on, you know, for the next, you know, 5 or 6 years. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And that is the unclear portion, is that we're talking about unknowns and then deciding what we do with them. So with a player, especially a player like Breshad Perriman or Kevin White, players that we don't really know, it's a huge risk to trade them. But one thing that I would throw in just with Perriman as the specific example is that historically rookies hold their value through 1 year, that after their rookie season, they tend to stay about the same value. After 2 years, then people start giving up on them if they're not succeeding. But I wouldn't be looking to sell a Breshad Perriman or a Kevin White at a discount. If you paid a third round price, which I kind of doubt, but if you paid that price, you shouldn't be selling for a fourth rounder. I would be, if you're going to move on, don't take a discount. Now, I've not looked at their specific ADPs. It could be that they've lost value, but in general, I wouldn't be looking to sell a rookie lower than I paid for him. And obviously, if you were just in a startup last year, you didn't pay a rookie draft cost for him, possibly, if rookies were in the startup. But for rookies, I would be looking to get an improvement on where I drafted people. So like a Tyler Lockett, people drafted late and now can get very good first round picks for him. That's gaining value on your team. Whereas if you draft someone in the first and sell them the next year for a second or a third, you've just given away value. You might as well wait and see what they do in their sophomore year instead.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, how do you relate future rookie picks to like a current startup pick? Like a first round rookie pick, where would that slot in terms of like a startup draft? Would that be roughly the equivalent of like a second round or third round pick in a startup?
That's a good question. I should, but I don't know the answer to that. That would be something I would have to look at.
What's your perception of that? I mean, it just kind of in the abstract, when you're thinking about, you know, your next rookie draft for a dynasty league, or I guess that it's the wrong way to look at it. If you were to do a startup now and someone offered you, just in the dark, like before it even started, I'll give you my first round pick in next year's rookie draft for your third round pick in the startup draft. Is that something you would pull the trigger on?
If we're talking, if I somehow knew it was 101, which you don't at a startup, then I think so. But if it's just a random first, I would much, much rather have the third round startup value.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's something you do need to kind of think about as you're doing a startup draft is where those future picks lie, because you're going to get offers. I know that I did in that one league. So I just had no idea what to do. I was basically frozen with my hands tied, scared, shivering like a poor little dog in a storm.
No, I very much on all those sorts of larger questions would have to do my own research and reach out to some folks. So do not take my dynasty strategy as here is the final answer.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. I do think it is interesting to talk about this stuff and think about it at the very least, just to get your brain moving in that direction, because you never know if you're going to get faced with those types of decisions. And if you've put even a little bit of thought into it ahead of time, that I think that can be really rewarding if and when, you know, the real thing happens. Do you have anything else you want to bring up on Dynasty in general? I know we have a long way to go before the draft and then again before, you know, the regular season. But anything else you want to touch on while we're on the topic?
No, I think we've done a good job of covering kind of the basics and particularly some unique features to two quarterback dynasty leagues. I think that's good.
And we'll,
we have a lot of, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, and we'll definitely get some bigger experts in the field than myself going forward as guests as the season approaches, because again, admittedly, I am not a dynasty expert. I am still learning a lot as we go. But with that said, I'd like to move on to our quarterback spotlight for the week. This is the Matthew Stafford experience, and Matthew Stafford's an interesting cat. He's in a spot where I feel like his value is about as low as it's been over the past few years in terms of just overall perception. I do think it's justified to some extent. I think that after, you know, that top 10 finish he put up in 2013, kind of similar to Rivers, it was easy to be like, well, Matthew Stafford is now an elite guy and we need to treat him as such. But over the past couple of years, he's kind of proven to be more of, you know, an average passer. And I'm curious to know, Josh, where you stand on Stafford, especially relative to Rivers, because we talked about your Rivers piece earlier. I was surprised to find out that Stafford, on average, had finished better than Rivers over the past 4 years. Now, my perception was contrary to that. Like, I immediately in my brain thought, well, no, Rivers is a better quarterback. How can that be? But what are the positives you see from Stafford, and what do you like about Stafford?
Yeah, it's been really surprising to me to see just how strong the hate has gotten for Matthew Stafford in the offseason. And obviously a huge part of that is the Calvin Johnson retirement speculation. And it is speculation at this point. Nothing's been announced, but it seems the odds are Calvin Johnson is gone. So there's reason for it just on that basis. But the hate is incredibly strong. Matthew Stafford right now, I've been in four different best ball drafts just in the last couple of weeks. And right now, Matthew Stafford's ADP is QB 22. He's going after Joe Flacco,
wow.
Jay Cutler, Alex Smith, Kirk Cousins. Just, it's incredible that he's fallen that far. And so much of my support for Matt Stafford is the price. And so I'm not a huge believer in Stafford as an NFL quarterback. I think he has some very big weaknesses and very glaring weaknesses, but what he does have is volume, and that he's been able to be a very reliable quarterback in the sense that, you know, he's going to be throwing and he's going to be a top 10 guy in terms of pass attempts, and that volume really does get you points. It may not be ideal. You'd rather have an Aaron Rodgers type of efficiency, but Stafford has gotten you points. If we look just at his recent years, he's now had five straight 4,000-yard seasons, and he's only 28. Kirk Cousins is also going to be 28 this year, and he's had one 4,000-yard season. Now, obviously, they haven't started the same number, but the point is you're taking players who are the same age, and you've got one who has proven this ability to put up volume and one who we've only seen one season of. And so to me, what we know is that Stafford is going to be throwing. He's going to have the volume, and I can get more into it. But what we actually have seen is that over the last 2 years, he's done just fine when Calvin Johnson is not playing at his normal level. So I am not all in on Stafford, but if you can get him at QB 22, that is just an insane fall that he's gone through.
That's a really nice value. That's a slam dunk at that point, especially because even in the last couple of years when he's been a quote unquote bad quarterback, he's still been right around the league average among, you know, quarterbacks who have started, most of the season. I mentioned this with Rivers as well, but in a 4 point per touchdown, negative 2 points per interception league, the average quarterback score per game in terms of fantasy points, among the quarterbacks who started at least 12 games, Stafford is right around there. We're talking about the average at 16.4 points, Stafford at 15.7. That was 2015, he was just above the average, the average being 18.04, and Stafford scored about 18.1 points per game. Again, this isn't sexy. This isn't, you know, super exciting. That might be, you know, close to his ceiling. But at the same time, there's no downside there either. And if you can get that sort of production with the 20th quarterback off the board, that's an opportunity you should pounce on in a two-quarterback league.
Right. And that's, I think he's much more interesting in our formats than he is in a one-quarterback league. But at that value, if you can get him at QB 20, QB 22, you're going to get very strong production out of your QB 2 position. And I have to expect that his price will rise as the offseason goes on, because I just don't think it can go much lower than that. I mean, the quarterbacks below him are so poor that I can't see him falling at all. I would expect he goes up at least a few spots before we hit August.
Yeah, I think it really is going to be contingent on whether or not Calvin Johnson does retire. Do you think he will, by the way?
I would not be surprised if he did. I'm not willing to bet that he will, but everything suggests that he's kind of beaten down. He's tired of losing, and his body has really taken a toll. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if he did at this point. What about you?
I have a feeling he's going to play again. I don't know if it'll be for the Lions, but I don't think he's done just yet. I wouldn't be surprised if he did come back to the Lions too, just to have, you know, give him one more shot. I mean, it does seem like it's too early for him to go, in my mind. And I don't really... I hope he plays more. Let's put it that way. One thing that I actually meant to bring up in episode one, and I forgot to, so I'm going to bring it up now, was a really good article I read by Evan Silva, kind of explaining what it takes to become a quarterback one, right? Someone who finishes as the QB one for a week, or inside the top 10 at the position. And one of the biggest correlations from, you know, quarterback success in fantasy was just if the team was winning. If your team wins games, then your quarterback production is going to be better. And I'll link to the Silva article just so you folks have it in the show notes. But that is a concern for me with Stafford, is the Lions have been a perennially bad team. How are they going to get better? Do we expect their running back situation to improve? I mean, I think Joik Bell just retired. Is that?
Yeah, I think he was given a forced retirement.
Oh, that's too bad. I mean, but there is a lot of, you know, kind of hype around Zach Zenner, Ameer Abdullah. Do you think those guys are enough to elevate Stafford if Calvin Johnson does retire? How many games can they win if he retires? Like, these are all questions we have to ask. I don't really have a hard answer for any of it, but I do have the concern that the Lions are going to be bad again. And their division isn't necessarily an easy one either. So when guys are losing, you know, it's easier for defenses to, you know, expect that team to pass, pick them off more, and prevent touchdowns in the passing game. And I don't think that bodes well for Stafford. What are some other red flags for you with him?
Yeah, I think that's right, that if he succeeds, it's going to be in the 2015 Blake Bortles mold of just he has to throw a lot because they're so bad. But I would say other red flags are, I'm not sure that this team without Calvin Johnson is very good at anything on offense. I mean, maybe those running backs that you mentioned step up, and I do like the talent both of them have, but we didn't see it this year. Golden Tate is good, but he's not an elite wide receiver one like Calvin Johnson was, and they really don't have anything behind him. maybe Eric Ebron steps up, but right now they're just kind of mediocre at everything. And is Matthew Stafford, I mean, that's one of the red flags, if I'm talking myself down on him, is you take a bad, inefficient quarterback and give him mediocre weapons as a whole. That is a red flag that we don't know what he looks like if the entire season he doesn't have Calvin Johnson.
Yeah, and while Johnson wasn't really himself this year in terms of, you know, previous production, he was still okay, you know, and if you lose that from the equation, then that does not bode well for Stafford. And at that point, maybe he does deserve to be the 20th or 21st quarterback off the board. I'm not sure. It'll be interesting to find out. Do you have anything else on Stafford before we move on to our Twitter questions?
I think the only other thing I was going to point out is something that I saw from Mike Beers. He's at Beerswater, just Beerswater on Twitter.
And my two favorite beverages.
I know, you put them together. That would actually be bad. I disregard that. he does what he calls charts on charts on charts, where he looks at weekly scoring, and he put Matthew Stafford and Ben Roethlisberger side by side over the last four seasons, and they look remarkably similar in what their weekly scoring looks like. And that is, I don't know which one that says more about, if Roethlisberger has been worse than we thought or Matthew Stafford has been better, but they have about the same distribution of weeks. If you look at, were they scoring more than 30 points, 25 to 30, it's all broken down. I'll send you the link to that tweet just so you can put it in the show notes. But I thought it was interesting to see how similarly they have been on a game-to-game basis.
Yeah, I think it's more a factor of Stafford being better than we expected than it is Roethlisberger being worse. Because like I said, even before I looked up, you know, the points per game stats, I really had it in my mind that Phillip Rivers was a much better fantasy quarterback than Stafford, and that's just not true. And I could see that, considering how much Stafford jumped up in my estimation, that would bring him a lot closer to the level of a guy like Roethlisberger or Tony Romo or Matt Ryan or whoever else. I'm not sure how much I'll own him next year, but if he does kind of retain this current value in that, even in that like QB 15 to 20 range, I'll probably have him in at least one league.
Right. No, I agree. And at least right now, I mean, it remains to be seen what the team is going to do behind Matthew Stafford, but right now he just doesn't have any competition. So it's not that they have some exciting quarterback behind him. They're kind of stuck right now in that quarterback purgatory where he is their guy.
Yep. All right. Well, with that out of the way, let's go to the tweets. I will start with the first question we have here. This is from at jbone9884. He says, would you rather have three top flight wide receivers and two mediocre quarterbacks or vice versa? And I'll start on this. I would much rather have the top flight wide receivers, especially because I get three of them. If the numbers were equal, I think it'd be a little trickier of a question, you know, two top flight wide receivers versus two top flight quarterbacks. But if I'm getting, you know, three elite talents at one position and two mediocre talents at the other, I'd much rather have the mediocre QBs.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And even if we're getting two and two, I think it's because quarterbacks have a much more reliable floor and they have much higher scoring in general, it's a safer bet to it's better for your team if you have the elite wide receivers you can count on, and then quarterbacks like a Joe Flacco and a Matt Stafford or something like that, because you at least know what you're getting. Whereas with wide receivers, you can get a zero, you can get a two. The quarterbacks, you know, are going to have volume and they're going to put up points.
Right. This goes back to that argument I was making earlier about how I'll almost always start a QB at my super flex, even if it's a bad QB. And that's my only option because the basement there is so high relative to the other positions. Next question is, from Dwayne Brown, he says, when comparing points and longevity between the quarterback and other positions, where do you apply the age line? What do you think?
What I am familiar with is research that's a couple of years old now, but Jonathan Bales and then also Austin Lee have put together research that suggests that the huge cliff at quarterback is at age 36. And it's a pretty remarkable drop off. And that's just looking at total fantasy points by age. And it is a really steep cliff after 36. And now, obviously, there are outliers. Some of the more recent quarterbacks stand out in our minds, but 36 is kind of the breaking point in what I've seen from the research, but I haven't run the numbers myself, and I haven't seen anything in the last 2 years because players like Brady and Manning have kind of skewed that a little bit. But that's kind of my general breaking point. I don't know if you have other thoughts on that.
I don't, but I will say that mileage can be different than age, right? Like, we talked about how Kirk Cousins, is the same age as Stafford, but they're both 28 years old, but, you know, Stafford has a lot more miles on his body. He's taken a lot more hits, to the point where I think you can, you know, skew the age line a little higher for Cousins. But with that said, there is just a general, you know, wear and tear of being a 36-year-old human being, whether you play football or not. You're going to lose a few miles off your fastball, to use a baseball analogy. Mm-hmm. I mean, every year I get older, the worse I feel. So
yeah, I just get out of bed and hurt, and I didn't get hit 30 times.
I went skiing for my one skiing trip this year, or per year, this past weekend, and I feel like I got mugged. But anyway, he does say between quarterback and other positions. I think that QB is definitely the one where you can expect production at the highest age, and running back is where, you know, it drops off the steepest. Wide receiver is probably somewhere in the middle, but it depends on, again, like, mileage and how often these guys are targeted, how many times they're going over the middle and getting hit. Like, I'd expect a guy like DeSean Jackson to play for a long time as long as he can run fast, right? But a guy like Larry Fitzgerald is truly remarkable because he has been that possession type of guy where he's, you know, catching a lot of passes every week, every season. And I think we started to see his decline this year. Calvin Johnson is another good example. It'll be interesting to see how long those guys hold on if they keep playing. Like, you look at Andre Johnson this past season, and that was just a train wreck. It seems like he should have retired after the 2014 season based on his production. But you can understand why they'd want to hold on. I mean, that's they're playing this game they love. They're getting paid a lot of money to play. And I don't know. The age thing is interesting. I tend to, in most fantasy sports, I tend to skew younger than older.
Right. And I think that your point about role is important because, like, to DeSean Jackson's speed, I think he'll lose speed at a younger age. And it's a question of, can he transition when he's not the fastest man on the field? I think that's what part of what made Larry Fitzgerald so successful is that he did morph his game and became more of a slot receiver as he got older. And I think that is something to take into account as well, to your point, is just, can they change their role when they are not the elite athlete and they're still good? I mean, we're talking about professional players. They're still obviously far above and beyond the normal person. But can they be okay when they are just on par with the defenders up against them? And can they find a way to win?
Yep. All right. The next question is from Steven Duke. He says, is Matt Ryan a sell low or a hold in a 12-team 2QB? I'm assuming he's talking about keeper or dynasty.
Yeah, I'm curious what you think on Matt Ryan. He's kind of I feel like the consensus has not really settled on him this year, but it's trending down.
Yeah, it definitely seems like his value has never been lower. And with that in mind, I wouldn't sell him anywhere. If anything, I'd be trying to acquire him or hold him in the hopes that his value goes back up. That's my general take.
Yeah, I agree. Since Steven's question is specific to a 12-team, two-quarterback league, quarterbacks are going to be at such a premium that while Ryan may be in a decline, and I think that's probably a topic for another podcast or article or something, but even if he is, he still is going to be easily a quarterback too. And I just don't know why you would sell him at what is likely a low point. I expect that his value will rise as we get closer to the season and possibly in the season as well.
Yeah, and speaking of age, he's still relatively young. I just don't think he can go much lower than he is now. And even, you know, with his current, like, value, he was still, like you said, a quarterback two candidate. I don't think you need to worry about Matt Ryan. If anything, I would hold him at this point.
Yeah, no, he'll be 31 going into the season, and that's fine as far as age goes. He's nowhere near the cliff, so that's not the concern with him.
Yeah, and it's not like there's anybody knocking on the door behind him. Like you talked about with Stafford earlier, there's no quarterback in waiting there who's going to take over for Matt Ryan. He's not going anywhere. I think in a 12-team league, you got to hold on to that value.
And if you just want nonsense quarterback news, for some reason, CBSSports.com has an article that the two guys we're talking about, Matthew Stafford and Matt Ryan, went on a Valentine's Day double date. So I feel like this probably means something.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
Feel free to segue from that.
Yeah, thanks. I can't do it. Next up, this is from, I wish I knew how to pronounce Tyler's last name. I'm so bad with this. Tyler Bucher? Boucher? At Ginger Sauce for you. It's got sauce in the name. I like that. 70% of Bortles attempts were with Jacksonville trailing. Can he keep his fantasy production up if and when Jacksonville improves as a team?
Yeah, Blake Bortles is, it's incredible to me. He is currently going as QB9 in best ball leagues. He's
unbelievable.
That is,
it's too high.
Remarkable. I mean, yeah, it's too high for sure, and it'll
I'm out
come
on
down.
Bortles.
But just looking at Jacksonville last season, the 70% stat that Tyler cites, if you look at inside the opponent's 10-yard line, is another way to look at it. They threw the ball 51 times and only ran the ball 30 times. That's a really high pass ratio. Some of that is because inside the 10, they were averaging 1.1 yards per carry, and that is atrocious. And just generally, Tyler has also been tweeting about how bad that rushing game was when they needed 2 yards or fewer, that they were just unbelievably inept. And so not only was the team bad that they were trailing and having to play from behind, but also the running game just wasn't moving the ball at all. So there was this whole confluence of factors that just pushed Bortles to succeed. And obviously some of them are still there. It's still not a great team. They still have Allen Robinson and Allen Hurns and Julius Thomas. So there's not, it's not as if the team is worse or the reasons are worse, but I think we don't, at least for me, we don't know what he looks like as far as if this team becomes more legitimate. But what isn't good is that he was so much more successful when the team was trailing. I mean, he completed 60% of his passes. He had 7.5 yards per attempt. Whereas when they were leading, he completed 5% fewer of his passes. He was a full 2 yards per attempt less, and his touchdown to interception ratio was worse when he was leading. So it's a smaller sample size, but I do have concerns and think that we are in for some very serious regression from Bortles for a whole host of reasons, not just because maybe they lead a little more than they did this season.
It's the blueprint that Matthew Stafford put together in 2013. You know, you're just playing from behind the whole time, chucking it to an elite receiver. And you can put up stats that way and you can be a good fantasy quarterback, but you also have to get a little lucky too. And I, based upon some of the throws you watch Blake Bortles make, I just can't imagine he's going to have the same sort of touchdown interception ratio again in 2016. There's just too many red flags for me to count on it. And plus there's no guarantee that Jacksonville does get better. And that's another, you know, red flag as well.
Right. And I think it's always important to say, look, there's a difference between NFL quarterbacking and fantasy quarterbacking. Teddy Bridgewater, a lot of people think he has NFL talent, but he's a terrible fantasy quarterback, or has been, I should say. Blake Bortles and Matthew Stafford at the other end of the spectrum may not be good NFL quarterbacks, but have put up fantasy value. So we have to make sure we distinguish. And you do this. This is not a correction, but just generally for everyone, I think it's important to remember we can believe that Blake Bortles will be a bad NFL quarterback and still have a debate over how good he'll be for fantasy.
Yeah, and I think that right now my impression is that he's going to be worse in both perspectives this time next year. I think that he'll be perceived, like his value is high right now as a, you know, a real NFL prospect as well as a fantasy prospect. But anyway, I think we've talked enough about Blake Bortles. Let's go next to Jason Brown. He asks, do you pursue quarterbacks more aggressively in 2QB dynasty startups than you would in redraft? And I'll start because I'm not an authority on this, but I would expect yes, if only because the longevity of the quarterback position is so good. And if you can get one of those top 10 type quarterbacks early on in a startup, then you can rely on that production for a long time and have a lot of trade value with that player, if you do need to make a move. What do you think?
I think that's right, and my hunch is that ADP would bear that out as well, that my feel of it is that quarterbacks go earlier in Dynasty for exactly the reason you said, that if you can get them, you have a reliable asset for years to come, whereas in redraft, you're much more okay waiting many rounds and picking up a Ryan Fitzpatrick or a Brian Hoyer or whoever the case may be, because it's just 1 year.
Yeah, it's pretty intuitive, I think. Next up is another question from Jason. He asks, how many QBs should you roster in a 12-team Dynasty Superflex league?
How many teams are in your Dynasty league, just the one you joined last year?
I believe it's 12 or 14.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's my sense, is that's kind of the norm, is right around 12. That seems to be the average. I don't know. I'm a bad person to ask because I hoard quarterbacks. I like those bad quarterbacks. So Jimmy Garoppolo, Mark Sanchez, I had Kirk Cousins, Geno Smith, all those guys I will keep on my team and use up a roster spot on them instead of a bad wide receiver. Or Hundley is another example of guys who maybe they don't get a shot, but I like the value spike that I'll get if they do become a starter. Even if they're not good, their value will just go through the roof if they're named a starter somewhere. And so I tend to hold on to 5 or 6 if in a typical 27 player or deeper roster. What about you? What would your sense be?
My gut is to say that I want at least 4 quarterbacks, if not more. And I'd probably err like you on the side of having 5 or 6 with just some backup guys stashed. For the same reasons you said, if you do have a guy who becomes a starter, the value delta is so large that you could, you know, flip him right away, especially to the owner who lost their starting QB, right? Maybe you find somebody who's needy because, you know, 2 of their guys got injured, and I'd rather be the guy who has more quarterbacks than less, if only because there are only 32 who get to start in any given week, and with bye weeks, it's actually less than that. So, I think that 4+ is my gut feeling.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay, next up is a question from Tyler Huggins, who says, I need Teddy Dino talk, general valuation versus peers and versus rookie pick X. So I don't know this X player that he's talking about. Have you ever heard of this guy?
I have no idea. Is that Dez Bryant?
I'd rather have Dez Bryant than Teddy Bridgewater. Next question.
All right, good. We're good here.
I do think we need to dive into Teddy Bridgewater in a deep way on a future episode, but give me your brief thoughts on his dynasty prospects.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a longer conversation, but in general, I'd be very out in a one quarterback league because I'm not sure the upside is there, but I think the stability and the way the team is making him the guy makes him more valuable in two quarterback leagues for reasons I've written about, just that stability and longevity factors.
Yeah, I'm pretty out on Teddy. I understand that he's a young player, but he really hasn't shown much so far. There is a lot of room for improvement when it comes to young QBs. Like, you'll see guys turn a corner after year 2 or year 3. We saw it with Derek Carr and Blake Bortles to some extent this year. I do worry about Teddy's just general team makeup as well. The way that the Vikings play isn't especially conducive to fantasy production from a quarterback, and that can change as well. But I'm generally out. I do think that now, because of, you know, where he's been producing, it would be a good time to buy him if you expect him to get better. I'm just not sure I buy that yet.
Yeah, no, he has really shaken a lot of people's confidence because he got into the top 5 or 6 at the position in Dynasty last year. And so people are just incredibly disenchanted. And so I think it's going to take some weeks and months over this offseason for people to really shake out the bias and decide how they feel about him based on the numbers.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the Vikings do, like if they add another receiver in the draft or, make a trade or something. I don't expect them to do that, but that would make me more interested in Teddy just if he had some more weapons that I cared about. But as it stands now with Adrian Peterson still being the focal point of that offense, his value is not something that excites me. Last question for the pod this episode comes from Don Davenport. He says, in a 12-team, two-quarterback dynasty league, which quarterback would you consider the same value as Sammy Watkins? That's a good question.
Well, funny you should ask. There is a source of information I like to use. Ryan McDowell over at DLF ran a couple of two-quarterback startup mocks just to see where people take players. And looking at Sammy Watkins, the quarterbacks, they're drafted right around his same range. Jameis Winston, Blake Bortles, and Derek Carr. So Marcus Mariota's a little later. That is roughly where the consensus has Sammy Watkins.
And that sounds about right to me, considering they all those guys came into the league in the same draft, right? And they were all pretty, or not all of them, but many of them. And they're all still young enough to the point where you can see that promise of future upside. I think Watkins is someone that I'd be a little more, I'd probably value him a little bit higher than those quarterbacks you listed. But again, that comes tied to my general late round quarterback philosophy.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the right area to value him. I mean, it's interesting to see that we have Jameis Winston, who followed a very similar path to Teddy Bridgewater's, that he is now jumping up into the top five or six at the position. And granted, he had a much better rookie season than Bridgewater did as far as fantasy goes, but he's a little more of an unknown commodity after only one season. Watkins, I think it's very easy to tell that he's an elite talent, and we know that. Winston is not an elite NFL quarterback. He could very well become that for all we know, but he is not that right now. Whereas Sammy Watkins, we've seen enough to say he is up there pushing for that elite tier, if not in that tier.
Yeah, it is worth noting that we're talking about draft value on these players, whereas, you know, if you're in a league that's been going for a while and these players are owned, like if you're trying to move Sammy Watkins, then it becomes a better question of, you know, what the Jameis owner needs. Like, do they need a running back? Do they need a wide receiver? Do they need another quarterback? And in that case, the valuations are going to differ a lot more, and that's a case-to-case basis.
Yeah, no, it's very true that startup versus in-season are different, because in-season, or at post-startup would be a better phrase. Post-startup, you do have context and you have team needs, and then it's a very different sort of calculus.
Yep. Well, we did it, Josh. We got through all of the Twitter questions, and with that, I want to move into our wrap-up phase for episode 2 here, the Matt Stafford Experience. I would like to urge all the listeners to subscribe to us if you can, iTunes, Stitcher, anything like that. We really appreciate the follow, as it were, on these podcast download sites. We do have an RSS feed on the show page at 2QBs.com. You should definitely check out the website. There's a lot of great content. We're going to have it going all through the offseason, and then we'll really ramp it up in the preseason. 2QBs.com. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at 2QBs, and you can always send us an email for those longer form questions at 2QBs@gmail.com. Josh, you got anything else you want to plug here before we take off?
I don't think so. We've been very grateful for all the support and all the people reaching out on email and Twitter and everywhere. So thank you very much. Let us know what else you'd like to hear this offseason.
Yeah, the more feedback we get from you guys, the better we're going to make this show, and that's really what we want to do. We want to give you guys what you want. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Greg Sauce. Josh, where can they find you?
I'm at Lake2QBs on Twitter, and then just 2QBs.com is where I'll be posting more content.
All right, man. Well, good second episode. We'll do it again ASAP, and thank you all for listening. Have a good night. We'll talk to you soon.